As you know, it's important to me that the supplements I recommend and use are of the highest quality. That's why I stock the Protocol for Life Balance product line at my online dispensary, drhoffman.com/protocolforlifebalance. Protocol for Life Balance offers a wide range of professional-grade products using ingredients backed by strong scientific research, including a suite of supplements that support mood and sleep: L-tryptophan, 5-HTP, GABA, and L-theanine. This collection provides essential amino acids and a serotonin precursor that support relaxation, restful sleep, and the regulation of mood and sleep-wake cycles, and are available in various potencies tailored to your specific needs. For more information and to order, just go to drhoffman.com/protocolforlifebalance. That's drhoffman.com/protocolforlifebalance. Protocol for Life Balance is an A-rated GMP manufacturer of premium dietary supplements created for healthcare practitioners. Their formulations are based on the latest advances in nutritional science. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Our guest is Gary Taubes, author of Rethinking Diabetes, What Science Reveals About Diet, Insulin, and Successful Treatments. The book has gotten really terrific reviews from some of the top people in the field. David Bernstein, to whom we referred in
Richard
hour
Bernstein.
One. I'm sorry, Richard Bernstein, a pioneer in this field, was the subject of what we were talking about last hour, and his advocacy for low-carb diets for type 1 diabetics. But I wanted to just, you know, pose the question, you know, many of your books are not diabetes oriented. Yes, your books talk about prevention of diabetes, but you also talk about low-carb dieting in general as a preventive measure for all manner of chronic health problems. So does everyone have to eat this way for optimal health, or is it different strokes for different folks?
Well, I'm going to divide that into two separate questions.
Okay.
So one of the issues that I've been writing about that's central to the science is we have chronic disease epidemics, obesity and diabetes epidemics, basically worldwide. The prevalence of these diseases have exploded. In the 1960s, there was a lot of work by British researchers, particularly associating these epidemics with Westernization. So traditional populations eating whatever their traditional diets are, begin trading with the West, and you start seeing their diets become Westernized, their lifestyles become Westernized, and their disease profiles become Westernized. So they start manifesting obesity, diabetes, heart disease, cancer, a dozen other chronic conditions, one of which is dental caries, so cavities. So an obvious explanation was that sugar and white flour are the primary vectors of this Westernization, because these were the things that were easiest to ship around the world back in the 19th century. They were the first things that were traded, first foods, stocks that were traded heavily. And when populations shifted to eating Western diets, they basically shifted to eating, adding sugar and white flour to their diets. And these British nutritionists or researchers turned nutritionists speculated that these were the triggers of these chronic disorders. So in that sense, I think they were most likely right.
So this is epidemiology. It's like, you know, in other words, it's one line of evidence that whatever we're eating and, you know, what are some of the prime ingredients in our diet, and there are many constituents, that it has dramatically escalated our risk for chronic degenerative diseases, many of which are related to blood sugar abnormalities, right?
Right, and insulin abnormalities,
yeah,
you could say. And the sugar white flour story, the reason I bought into it, it's what physicists would have called robust. It shows up everywhere. Everywhere I looked, you found researchers implicating sugar and the glycemic index, how quickly the carbohydrates could be digested and absorbed into the circulation, as probable causes of disease states, even explaining, you know, in diabetes primarily, the explanation for why patients who have poor blood sugar control have such high rate of complications. So getting back to prevention, on one level, a healthy diet would be a diet that doesn't include sugar and white bread. So, which is some way place the whole nutrition world has been going, the conventional wisdom as well. As soon as they use the phrase whole grains, they're saying, in effect, don't eat white bread. Mm-hmm. And nobody really considers sugar part of a healthy diet, but they also don't like to tell people what not to eat. So they'll tell you to eat fruits, vegetables, whole grains, lean meat, and in moderation, fish, legumes, and then that will be the definition of a healthy diet. And then they'll hope that you don't drink too many Coca-Colas or fruit juices or eat too many desserts or sweets.
But what they're not saying, though, is not what you are saying as a recipe for treatment of real diabetes, not merely for prevention in active, metabolically healthy people, because that calls for more drastic restriction of starchy vegetables, of excess, even fresh fruit, legumes, and even in some cases, virtually a carnivore ketogenic diet, right?
And this is where you cross the line, and this is where it gets so tricky. In fact, my career as a journalist shifted dramatically from the point I wrote a book called The Case Against Sugar, mm-hmm. which everyone was willing to buy into, and I'm reviewed on the front page of the New York Times Book Review, which is mm-hmm. a tremendous honor.
That was an acceptable message. That was acceptable.
Yeah, that's an acceptable message. The next book was called The Case for Keto, which is precisely what you just made.
Yeah.
For many of these metabolic disorders, from obesity to type 2 diabetes to a whole range of chronic disorders that at least anecdotally get better or go into remission.
Even psychiatric disorder, and I just saw your post on X, formerly known as Twitter, about a new study that looks at the impact of a ketogenic diet on alcoholism. Wow.
This is, yeah, actually the head of the National Institute of Drug Abuse is giving a seminar today on what they call keto therapies for alcohol use disorder. Keto therapy is a new way to phrase ketogenic diets, which when you and I were young used to be called Atkins. With some minor variations, mm-hmm. but because these are always on the fringe of medicine, you have to keep changing the terminology, A, so that a new generation of doctors can proclaim that they've discovered something new, and B, because the old terminology gets tainted with quackers. So you would never have a symposium hosted by the head of the National Institute for Drug Abuse saying that an Atkins diet might be a good treatment therapy for alcohol use disorder, but you can call it keto therapy and then it sounds acceptable.
It's like liberals were rebranded progressives, and maybe if that gets tainted, that brand gets tainted, there'll be a new term. I was just going to ask you, though, there is controversy still about, you know, what you've laid out. Essentially, it's the carbohydrate insulin model of obesity, which is that obesity is an endocrine disorder, which is driven by alterations that can be related to diet. They could certainly be, at least, you know, lack of exercise can partake of that, but diet is the primary driver of this disinsulinemia, which leads to a vicious cycle of weight gain, and then ultimately that breaks down, you get insulin resistance, your blood sugar goes up, you become diabetic. And then there are the folks who, and they argue with the carbohydrate insulin model folks like you and Dr. David Ludwig, with an alternate theory, the energy balance theory. So how you are a skilled debater. You've entered into the fray, and I think you've been in some forums where you've actually debated this with proponents of the opposite theory, which is that it's kind of a calories in, calories out model. And don't get so excited.
Although I don't know how much I demonstrated my skill. in those debates, if I am a skilled debater. The the conventional wisdom, and this is a story I've told in every book, and it tends to get ignored. This was part of among the revelations. Like I said, when you go back in through history, looking at the evidence base of our belief system, which is what scientists are always supposed to do, as are ideally physicians, one of the revelations I came upon was that until the World War II, initially there were two theories of obesity. One is that people get fat, just eat too much, and that was based on the observation I called like the Falstaff theory. You know, here's this big, enormous guy who's a glutton who's eating enormous amounts of food.
It's a moral flaw, one of the seven deadly sins. Yeah, right.
So you assume that the gluttony caused the obesity, even though all you're seeing is an association. Gluttony and obesity are associated. Mm-hmm. But you can also disassociate them, and the physicians knew this. Everybody knew people who didn't eat a lot at all, who really restricted. Some of these early 20th century physicians, researchers, had friends, colleagues who were obese and clearly didn't eat a lot of food. So how do you explain them? And this was a sort of constitutional predisposition theory, that people get fatter or predisposed, and it was worked out in the 1920s and 1930s.
So-called slow metabolism.
Well, it became a slow metabolism theory, but initially it wasn't.
Okay.
So the idea that people get fat because they eat too much, the gluttony theory, was based on supplemented by the major trend in nutrition science from the 1860s through 1920, which was you could measure energy expenditure in people. They had developed a technology called calorimeters that allowed you to measure energy expenditure. And so now before that, you could measure the energy in the foods people ate. Now you could measure the energy that they expended by putting them in these calorimeters. And so you could do energy balance. You could measure energy in and energy out. Mm-hmm. And that was all you could measure that seemed relevant to obesity. Remember, your theories, as we talked about with insulin and insulin resistance, are dependent on the technologies you have available. Mm-hmm. So by beginning around 1895, German researchers said, look, this is an energy balance disorder. They had taken the gluttony disorder, applied it to the calorimetry work, and said people are consuming more energy than they're expending. And then from about 1900 through 1920, a whole range of German and Austrian researchers, so they were doing the best medical science in the world, bar none, tried to establish that obese individuals somehow consume more than lean people, or they expended less than lean people, or maybe they expended less after exercise, or maybe they expended less during physical activity, and they just couldn't do it.
Their resting metabolism was less efficient. They were, in effect, you know, some people just sitting here having this conversation with you were burning calories, but perhaps some people burn at different rates.
And when you're heavier, you tend to burn more because your body's bigger. And when you move around, you tend to burn more because you're moving greater weights of your body. So it's sort of, and they tried to measure maybe it's energy expenditure per cubic centimeter of body or by surface area. And they just, finally, a German, very famous German internal medicine specialist said, maybe it's just not an energy balance disorder. Maybe it's a constitutional disorder. Maybe it's these people have fat tissue, just wants to accumulate more fat than other people. And by 1930, this was basically the accepted theory in Germany and Austria. The textbooks had shifted to talking about obesity as a constitutional sort of hormonal nervous system disorder. They knew the nervous system played a profound role in stimulating fat release from fat cells. And then in 1931, this American comes along, Louis Newberg, and he says, I've experimentally proven that obesity really is a gluttony disorder. It's an energy balance disorder. Everyone who gets fat does so because they take in more calories than they expend, and that's all there is to it. And he gives publishes the same data in three different papers, and the Germans and Austrians basically make fun of him because he so misunderstands everything they've been doing. And then World War II sets in, and the German and Austrian medical research community vanishes.
And they go into disfavor, too, because, like, who wants that German stuff?
And they go into disfavor. And nobody's going to read the German language medical literature. German, right. Pre-World War II was the lingua franca of medicine.
Right.
Now, no one's reading it. It's gone. It's like it never happened.
Right.
It's fascinating. And simultaneously, in the 1930s, you see the first animal models of obesity. And those are interpreted via this idea of Newberg. These people believe that Newberg, they're reading the American journals, not the German and Austrian journals. So they believe Newberg proved that obesity is caused by eating too much.
So from this then is an on, example of a wrong turn in medicine and science. Suggesting that bad ideas have legs sometimes, and you know, it's hard
if
to
if they support what seems to be common sense.
Yep.
People will embrace. They won't question them because they seem obvious. When I first got into this field, I just assumed, like everyone else, that I got fat or was getting fatter because I ate too much, and so you constantly, you know, those people like me who tend to gain weight easy. We're on diets our whole life. We're constantly restricting what we're eating, but it doesn't prevent the weight gain. And no matter what you say to an obesity researcher, he will tell you you're either not exercising enough or you're eating too much, without any awareness of how much I'm eating or how much I'm exercising. So again, you go back in time. I mean, it was really quite a stunning revelation. What's even weirder is, it's at beginning in 1939 or so, you get the first animal models of obesity. So obesity becomes amenable to experimentation. Hard to do experiments on humans, and usually unethical. And every animal model, every major animal model supports this constitutional hormonal hypothesis of obesity. But post-World War II, the researchers, mostly American, doing this research don't even know there was a constitutional hormonal thesis of obesity. So they continue to try and interpret these as caused by eating too much. Whatever you do to the animal, whether it's genetic or surgical, you've made that animal eat too much, and that's why it got fat.
It seems like a very kind of a Newtonian, very kind of outmoded way of looking at science, you know, because Einstein had the theory of relativity that kind of exploded our kind of two-dimensional view of how physics works. And I think we needed a revolution in the way we understand metabolism and its relationship to obesity.
Yeah, it's interesting. Look at these new GLP-1 agonist drugs like Wegovy.
I was going to mention,
I mean, they're remarkable for weight loss. The assumption is because the weight loss associates with people inhibition of appetite. It's now wildly assumed that these drugs work by inhibiting appetite. Even the I've seen the media, they have very good newspapers referring to them as appetite suppressant drugs.
Right. The tagline is they work on the brain. That's the tagline.
Yeah. That they work on the brain, they make you eat less. And because they also seem to have some effect on other compulsive behaviors, that confirms everyone's belief that it's just that simple. You give this very powerful drug in the periphery, below the neck, and its major action is somehow it works its way up to the brain and tells you not to eat. And that could be true, but it's highly unlikely. And it ignores this entire science of fat metabolism that was worked out from the 1930s onward,
the knocks on the carbohydrate insulin model, you know, which is a model that, you know, you espouse and low carb eaters and advocates espouse, is that these very diet drugs actually increase insulin production. And at the very same time as that they increase insulin production, you get weight reduction. So doesn't that fly in the face of the carbohydrate insulin model?
It does. It's actually kind of.
How do you explain that paradox?
Well, that would be the question, and that's what I would ask them to. So the way it's used is to argue that insulin is not actually a fattening hormone.
Right.
So it's used to refute, in effect, 70 years of research that's never really been questioned. Actually, even these diabetes studies we talked about in the first half of our interview, you give people intensive insulin therapy, they gain more weight than if you give them the usual insulin doses. Insulin is a fattening hormone that is completely accepted by the leading authorities, I mean, leading obesity and diabetes researchers in the field in the 1960s and 1970s. So the question would be, how do you have a drug that stimulates insulin secretion and causes weight loss? And that would be an interesting, if I were a professor at a university, which I will clearly never be, and I had young students, I would say, let's work through this. And this is an interesting assignment for thesis, because there are two things we know. One of them is that insulin is, it inhibits release of fat from the fat cells. It stimulates fat uptake. It inhibits burning of the fat in other cells, particularly the liver. I mean, that's all been well worked out science. Is it just wrong? And if it's not wrong, what else are these drugs doing? As it turns out, while the molecule itself, GLP-1, does stimulate insulin secretion in the short term, when you look at the long term, these drugs, they also insulin sensitize. So insulin
they work on, levels
drop.
Glucagon, which is from the liver. And glucagon actually is the counter-regulatory hormone for insulin. So maybe there's a balancing act there.
And I would bet significant sums of money that the primary action is on glucagon and what glucagon is doing in the liver. But one of the arguments I make in this book is that the medical community has taken such simplistic views of both the actions of insulin and the role of glucagon and this idea that we get fat merely because we eat too much, that they are almost incapable now of thinking in the physiological, rational ways that would lead them to deeper understanding.
Another reason I think that a diabetologist...
And by the way, every quack sounds like me. I just want to say that as I say that, I realize that I could be spouting complete nonsense and I would have said something very similar because I'm trying to explain.
But the method works. I mean, that's understand the mechanism, but so many people have benefited from low carb dieting. I just want to point out one of the things you mentioned in the book that I think is a very accurate point is that there's some confusion by many doctors. You know, we learn about ketoacidosis. In fact, we experience it, you know, during our training. It's like the ultimate crisis for diabetics. It can be life-threatening. Ketones appear in the urine and in the blood, and it can be life-threatening and it can kill you. There's a difference, though, between ketoacidosis and ketosis, as is a benign form of ketosis, which prompts reduction in appetite and weight loss in a low-carb diet. So explain why that threw diabetologists off the track, because they were very fearful of inducing ketosis in diabetics, right?
And this is, but I'm going to correct one thing you said, that ketosis and the ketogenic diet associates with appetite inhibition and weight loss. But we don't know if, again, it also associates with reducing insulin. The only way you get the ketosis is by minimizing insulin. And the thing insulin does is also going to, by minimizing insulin, you're going to stimulate lipolysis and fat's going to come out
lipolysis,
of the fat
cells. Which is fat burning in layman's terms.
So it's we have a sort of circular homeostatic systems, and when our brains tend to pick one point that we're going to start at and call that the causal effect when all these things are happening simultaneously. The ketoacidosis was often the end state of type 1 diabetes, diabetic ketoacidosis and coma. It was ketones were first discovered in the urine of an uncontrolled diabetic patients who are in the process of dying. So diabetes specialists naturally thought that this was something they had to avoid at all costs, and that a diet that stimulated ketogenesis, the generation of ketones from the liver, could easily lead to ketoacidosis and kill patients. And if used incorrectly by patients with type 1 diabetes, and you know, that things can always go awry.
Right.
So if you just go up.
Don't try this at home if you're a type 1 diabetic using insulin. Yeah. You really need guidance, because you can put yourself into a tailspin. Yeah.
Well, that's after one of my interviews like this. I got an email from a woman who said she was a type 1, and she's having heard me talk, she was going to go off insulin. And they responded immediately, like, no, 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 no.
We have a nice long medical disclaimer at the end of every podcast. So I think
I hope I got to her in time. I hope she read her email before she decided. Yeah. The what's interesting about this ketosis, diabetic ketoacidosis thing, is that the diabetes specialists and physiologists in the early 20th century and the late 19th century knew that these were two different states. They knew that there was a nutritional ketosis, that if you went for a day without eating, your ketone levels mm-hmm. would go up. Mm-hmm. They knew that if you didn't eat carbohydrates, your ketone levels would go up, and that this was completely benign.
Physiologic.
And they would talk about this in their lectures. But most of the people treating patients with diabetes were not diabetes specialists. They were physicians who just equate, you know, in doctor's offices nationwide, who weren't reading the journals closely, weren't reading the textbooks closely.
And they weren't physiology professors who had a more nuanced understanding of this. So, right.
So these very simplistic ideas, ketosis equals diabetic ketoacidosis, became easily accepted. And then when Atkins came along in the 60s, pushing a ketogenic diet, this was considered heresy, because to the world of physicians who had ever treated a patient with diabetes, the last thing they wanted to see was ketones.
Right. And one final point, because you've been very generous with your time, and if you have a moment, I just want you to address this, because one of the knocks on the low-carb diet, ketogenic diet, is, you know, they admit now, you can lose weight, you can help your blood sugar control, you can even drop your blood pressure, all kinds of benefits ensue. But for some patients, we see a dramatic spike in the so-called bad cholesterol, the LDL cholesterol. And there's a new theory which is called the lean mass hyperresponder theory. They actually have an acronym for it, the LMHR theory. Mm-hmm. And what they say is, fine, these diets, they used to say this about Atkins, like, great, you know, you follow the diet, but you'll be ultimately a skinny corpse. So what say you, because I'm sure you're confronted with this conundrum.
Well, this was always this was what what prevented Atkins. I mean, it was thrown in Atkins' face from the very beginning. He played up the high fat, high saturated fat aspect of his diet. He talked about eating triple cheeseburgers without the bun and lobster Newberg. He had decided that the cholesterol theory was wrong.
Very Upper East Side diet, by the way. You know, that's where he was from. He was on Sutton Place, and so you could dine out at all the steak places with impunity.
Yeah, exactly. And the assumption was he's going to kill people. This is it. The LDL is going to go up, and LDL did go up. When I was first doing my research, I talked to Pete Ahrens, who was one of the leading, probably the leading lipidologist in the world. He was at Rockefeller University, brilliant scientist. And there aren't that many brilliant scientists in these fields. And Aaron said he had a patient who was a Broadway actress who was on Atkins, and her total cholesterol was at 600.
Yep.
And so they saw this. It wasn't unusual, and they assumed it would kill people because of a lot of different reasons. The genetic high LDL cholesterol tends to associate with heart disease and death, although even that evidence depends who you listen to. Anyway, that was it. The way I think about it is simple. Diets do a lot of things. Okay, so you eat a diet with carbohydrates, a diet without carbohydrates, you have profound differences throughout your body, and in one, you're metabolizing mostly carbohydrates for fuel, in the other, you're metabolizing mostly fat for fuel. Virtually every blood marker you look at is going to be different between those two, and a lot of those blood markers associate with health or not, and LDL cholesterol happens to be the one that our medical community focused on as absolutely crucial to heart disease. And that was the very first second investigation I did when I was still working for the journal Science that got me into this world. And the evidence for diet, for drug manipulation of LDL cholesterol, for statin use, again, it's all in the eye of the beholder, but I'll buy the fact that it prevents heart disease in some patients. But what a diet does and a drug does is two entirely different things. And so if you know, among the most significant risk factors for heart disease include overweight and obesity and poor blood sugar control and low HDL cholesterol and high triglycerides and high blood pressure, metabolic syndrome, effect, and all of that will get better.
Right.
So if all these other risk factors get better and your LDL goes up, whether this lean mass hyperresponder theory is right or not, the question is, are you getting healthier? And
That's a good answer. I think that's a good answer because you're improving all these other parameters. One parameter goes awry. But actually what they pointed out in a recent study is that, and I've noticed this too, is that patients going on a keto diet or a very low carb diet, if they're very overweight, they'll actually improve their lipid panels. That's what Atkins always said. So he mostly saw overweight people. But if a lean person undertakes this for whatever reason, they are more likely to spike their LDL, which makes it actually less consequential because they are already metabolically okay. It's just their body's adaptation to deprivation of carbohydrates that they actually, the body's compensating. The body is sending out fuel in the form of these little packets called low-density lipoproteins to the tissues, the brain and the heart and, you know, all the organs that depend on fuel, and that's an adaptation rather than a serious risk factor, especially in these are lean individuals generally who have these remarkable spikes of LDL.
Remember that the obese individuals, if they adhere to this diet, in theory will become lean.
Yeah. Eventually they'll become
lean. And at that point, their LDL is likely to go up. We really don't know what percentage of the population. I had my LDL was fine for a decade, and then it went up. And I have my own.
So you became a lean mass hyper responder, in effect, over time.
You know, I mean, it's doing me. I'd love to think of my body as lean, as opposed to just not as thick as it used to be.
Before you undertook the diet, and you were overweight, because I've always known you as being of normal weight, but I've only known you for as long as you've been talking about these issues.
Well, I was a football player in college. I am at the high school, I was 6'2", 195 pounds. By the time of my senior year in college, I weighed 240 pounds, because what you try to do is bulk up when you're a football player.
The training table diet,
The training, we had every other night, we were at the local deli eating 3,000 calories of sandwiches at midnight. It's just what you can do when you're young and maybe athletic. I tend to get heavy. I have a brother who tends to be lean, and I tend to the way I described it in my last book, one of these people who can fatten easily. Mm-hmm. By the time I was 30, I was back up to around 230 pounds, gaining, say, 2 pounds a year. It's just what my body did, and I worked out all the time, and I resisted eating as much as I wanted, and I gained 2 pounds a year.
But you were on an omni diet, on a probably reasonably good diet.
Well, through the 90s, I was on a very low-fat diet.
Okay.
Ludicrous. I lived in LA. I had a friend who had hired a personal trainer who was the healthiest human being I had ever seen. Mm-hmm. And he said, if you eat this diet with virtually no added fats at all, you will lose 6 pounds in 2 weeks and be happy forever after. And I kept that
up. So like a Pritikin style diet. Yeah.
Very close. I could tell you, I used to joke that in the 90s, I boiled 10,000 eggs and threw out 10,000 yolks.
Oh, no.
It was lunch was pasta with fresh salsa. I wouldn't even put olive oil in the water because that's a fat. God knows how many skinless chicken breasts I ate. I still have the diet on a piece of paper. It's whenever somebody tells me that it's seed oils that make you fatter, I say, find the seed oils I was eating in the 90s because I was gaining 2 pounds a year. Then I tried Atkins as an experiment. I was writing about dietary fat, this investigation for Science, and I was simultaneously as a freelancer doing an article for Discover Magazine on the mathematics of the stock market. So I was up at MIT interviewing a guy who runs the Laboratory of Economic Engineering at MIT. And we got to talking about good science and bad science. I started talking about how bad the science was in the nutrition world and this dietary fat story I was doing. And he said, if you're doing a piece on dietary fat, you have to try Atkins. And he said his collaborator at Wharton, his father had lost 200 pounds on Atkins. Wow. So he did it personally. He's Asian American and he lost 40 pounds. He said he basically gave up white rice. So I went back to Los Angeles where I was living and my parents had passed away. The only one who would care if I gave myself a heart attack might have been my cats. And so I launched into Atkins with the eggs and bacon in the morning and, you know, a steak and cheese at lunch and chicken, steak or fish with green vegetables at dinner. And I lost 25 pounds in 2 months without seeming to try.
Wow.
And ate what I thought were enormous amounts of food. It's a fascinating phenomenon. I mean, I used to try and convince obesity researchers to do it because I had been on a diet every day since I graduated from like December 1976, since football ended. And suddenly I'm eating massive amounts of these foods that I'm convinced will give me a heart attack. And I'm losing weight effortlessly, so much so I kind of stopped exercising for a while because I used to do all this running and
you found that the exercise was super
biking to burn off calories. And it was like, why am I doing this? It's a fascinating phenomenon.
Do you mind sharing your current weight? Because I'm talking to you on a Zoom call. Our listeners can't see this, but, you know, on the picture, you look very lean.
I'm probably around 215 now. Again, okay.
You're
tend
a tall
to
guy.
Weigh myself.
How tall are you?
I'm 6'2", 215, okay. 210 to 215. That, again, consider my boxing weight when I had an ill-conceived boxing career was 212.
Okay. So
that's when I was in the best shape of my life.
That's like fighting trim. You're in fighting trim. Yeah.
Fighting trim, yeah. Like I said, I've been as high as 240, both for football and then, you know, prior to figuring out the Atkins thing. I suspect had I continued on the path I was on, I would have easily got up to 250 or 60 pounds.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, because it's just harder and harder. Quote, the metabolism slows down, right? And you
But again, I don't think it's the metabolism slowing down. I think it's the body becoming more insulin resistant.
Oh, yes.
So you spend more time in an elevated insulin state unless you have less access to your own fat stores in effect. So
it's
you
a good way of looking
it's
at
like it. A socket wrench. It'll take up fat, but it won't let it out.
Good way of looking at it. Well, you've been very generous with your time. I really appreciate you visiting with us. And the book is fantastic. It's Rethinking Diabetes, What Science Reveals About Diet, Insulin, and Successful Treatments. And you're really going to, if you read the book, you're going to get a very, very authoritative review of the history of diets, the history of science as pertains to diabetes, but not just diabetes, as pertains to the whole problem of obesity that we're currently contending with. So additional resources, Gary, a website, or you want to point us to somewhere?
Well, I do a Substack now with the journalist Nina Teicholz. It's called Unsettled Science.
Great. I love that. Mm-hmm.
And it's quite a lot of fun to write more frequently than one book every 3 or 5 years. So, and we're always addressing these subjects, usually related to diet and chronic disease.
What's
and,
the latest subject you're how, tackling?
Well, at the moment, Nina is writing about ultra-processed food addiction. We're mm-hmm. not wowed by the science. And I've got two pieces in the works, one on why the evidence for mostly plant diets is so dependent on the science of observational epidemiology. Why a tool that the medical community considers valueless
yeah.
is considered the basis of our belief that we should eat mostly plants. Mm-hmm. And just another piece that I started today on a new study that came out saying that mice get fat because they like the fattening food too much. And it's so inane that I can't help but
where could that possibly go wrong? You know, another mouse
yeah,
study.
Really.
Right.
Well, this is the title will be something like, Do We Care Why Mice Get Fat?
Okay, that sounds good. We look forward to that. Yeah. So good stuff. Okay, so that's available on Substack via
Substack.
Okay, good.
Yeah. We'll Unsettled Science.
Unsettled Science. Great stuff. Rethinking Diabetes, great book. I recommend that you go out and buy it. Gary, thanks again for your time and all the best to you. And, you know, keep us apprised of, you know, what you're working on. And we'll get you back on soon again, as we have in the past. All the best.
Okay. Thank you, Ron.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I want to thank you for listening to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or your favorite podcast app, and get new episodes automatically downloaded every weekday. And please give us a rating and review. It truly helps new people discover Intelligent Medicine. The Intelligent Medicine Podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice, and no doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of information on this podcast or materials linked from this podcast is at the user's own risk. The content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice for any medical condition they may have and should seek the assistance of their health care professionals for any such conditions. Finally, please visit drhoffman.com and discover everything Intelligent Medicine has to offer, including frequently updated, unbiased health news and fully vetted product and supplement recommendations. You know how important it is to ensure that your supplements are genuine, safe, and effective. That's why I partnered with Fullscript, an online dispensing platform that only offers curated professional-grade brands that I know and trust, the very same supplements that I prescribe to my patients and take myself. Never counterfeit or expired, always stored and shipped correctly. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com to start your free Fullscript account. Buying through Fullscript offers fast shipping, optional refill reminders, a mobile-friendly site. It's safe, secure, and HIPAA-compliant and offers world-class support. Fullscript also gives you access to my custom targeted supplement protocols that combine the products that I recommend to address specific needs, heart health, immune support, and much more. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com to sign up for your free Fullscript account. You'll get access to the supplements and features you need to help you achieve your wellness goals. That's DearHoffmanStore.com. DearHoffmanStore.com.